Beyond Belief by Hunter Hawk. In the last several months, we've been tested by fear, by uncertainty, and by loss. We've seen true heroism on display at checkout counters, senior care centers, hospitals, food banks, and beyond. Many have spent a lot more time at home, whether going it alone or negotiating space with loved ones. We've taken stock of ourselves and our work and our bank accounts and our families, before and during. And we've wondered what would come after. Here at CNI, we've seen our Dallas-based staff scatter from the office to our homes to produce an entire issue of the magazine remotely. The very one you're looking at now. Its preparation just so happened to involve a big-picture examination of past presidents and historic decisions that affected generations. We've always joked about the crazy perspective we've developed behind the scenes at this magazine. At any given moment, we're evaluating the past, producing and editing the present, and planning meticulously for the future. This frenetic magazine modus operandi was weirdly soothing as we all faced unanswerable questions and lingering anxieties surrounding a worldwide health crisis. Amid the turmoil, work felt good. Creating an issue that would be in your hands 6 weeks after it left ours felt hopeful. We sought inspiration in the stories we were working on and found it especially in the tale of Theodore Roosevelt's life-changing experience in Dakota Territory and his exhortations about courage and leadership. And we found real-time connection and solidarity with the magazine's partners and friends, many of whom were grappling with a new and unpredictable economic reality. We did whatever we could to stay safe and remain brave, but like so many of you, we couldn't completely avoid the worst. News came in mid-April that we'd lost one of our most talented and longest-serving colleagues to complications from the virus. Angelo Gandino, 70, was a beloved newsstand business veteran based out of New York, who had helped CNI succeed in the ever-changing publishing landscape for the last 15 years. He worked closely and spoke frequently to our chief financial officer, Ann Kidd. Angelo had a great understanding of the history of the business. He knew everyone and could remember everything, Ann says. At the end of every call, Angelo would say something about his family, about his wife, Rosalie, or his grandsons, Joey and Anthony. We would laugh about something and remind each other what was really important in life. In this special issue, you'll read more about Angelo, about other treasured people we've lost, about beautiful places we love and long for, and about historic figures whose lives continue to inform and guide us. Together, we can reach for perspective over panic, hope over fear, discipline over chaos. We can try to emulate the inner strength and perseverance we've admired in our lost loved ones. And we can encourage in each other the resilience and humanity that will see us through. Theodore Roosevelt's resolve. How the Dakota Territory put the rough in the Rough Rider, who would go on to shape the American West more than any other president, by Matt Crossman. The Little Missouri River is the color of hot chocolate as it slithers through the badlands of North Dakota. I watch as it slowly cuts a meandering path just outside of where Theodore Roosevelt's Elkhorn Ranch once stood. The ranch is gone now, but the reasons our 26th president moved here, stunning beauty, isolation, ruggedness, remain. Out here, it doesn't change very much, says Rolf Sletten, a Roosevelt biographer who is giving me a tour of Roosevelt's stomping grounds in and around Medora, North Dakota. The view from Roosevelt's front yard is dominated by the river and several enormous cottonwoods, craggy and misshapen, as if years of being alone has left them twisted and grotesque. Pictures from Roosevelt's era here, 1884 to 1887, show some of those same trees, then young, fresh, and vibrant. The Elkhorn's backyard faces west, where gray buttes swallow the view, stretching north and south as far as I can see. A light spring breeze cools my skin, which was warmed by the walk in from a nearby parking area. Birds sing in praise of the beautiful spring day, 65 and sunny, ideal conditions to sit on Roosevelt's long-gone veranda that overlooked the river. Sletten, my friend John, and I settle for sitting on foundation stones as we sip coffee and tea and ponder this remote spot's importance in American history. Roosevelt was born and raised in New York. He turned himself into an icon of Western resilience here. I think it's the most sacred place in North Dakota because of the way it influenced Roosevelt and his conservation policies, Sletten says. If Roosevelt hadn't moved here to live as a cowboy and rancher, he would not have led the charge up San Juan Hill. Without leading the charge up San Juan Hill, he would not have become governor of New York. Without becoming governor of New York, he would not have become vice president. Without becoming vice president, he would not have become president. And if he had not been president, the West would not be the West as we know it today, as his conservation policies have influenced it for more than 100 years. The West changed him, and then he changed the West. Still, for all the change this place wrought, it remains largely as Roosevelt left it 133 years ago, when he moved back east to eventually lead a long and colorful career in politics, the apex of which was his years as president, 1901 to 1908. You can still see what he saw, hear what he heard, and feel what he felt, Sletten says. I've traveled to Medora to do just that, from the Elkhorn Ranch to the National Park that bears Roosevelt's name, to the Badlands he roamed on foot and horseback. I want to walk where he walked, ride where he rode, and explore where he explored to try to understand how this high society New York intellectual became the most Western president our country has ever had. The first thing you learn about Roosevelt in North Dakota is not to call him Teddy. He hated it. If you get tired of calling him Roosevelt, call him T.R. As a young man, Roosevelt was brilliant and precocious, but also sickly and asthmatic. He was most likely to be found at his desk studying animal anatomy. Forced indoors by his bad health, he showed few early inclinations toward an active life of adventure. He was nowhere near the man who became the rough rider, hunter, and rugged outdoorsman. Nothing of the brawn and muscularity he would acquire driving himself to the point of exhaustion riding horses and doing ranch work. So how did he change from a bookish boy to a war hero, conservationist, and model of the adventurous life? He spent summers here in what is now North Dakota. In those days, life in the Dakota Territory was a constant struggle against the elements, a far cry from the life of wealth and ease he had been born into, the scion of an influential New York family descended from Dutch immigrants. Roosevelt wasn't just learning to endure physical difficulties. he was dealing with emotional struggles too. His mother and his wife died on the same day in 1884, and he retreated to the Dakota Territory. He came here to hide from the world and recreated himself in the process. Now the land around where he spent those formative years is a national park, the Theodore Roosevelt National Park, the only one named after a person, encompasses 70,000 acres of harsh landscapes and rugged beauty. My friend John and I arrived there on a Thursday afternoon with our backpacks and tents, hoping to get a sense of what Roosevelt loved so much about it. It didn't take long. After a visit to Maltese Cross, a cabin Roosevelt lived in that has been moved to the entrance of the national park, we put our boots on the TRNP's Petrified Forest Trail, and soon we found ourselves amid the leftovers of a forest up to 57 million years old. I wouldn't have known those things were petrified trees if I didn't already know. They looked like orange, brown, and white gargoyles, rejected for being too hideous. One of them was 15 paces around. Another was taller than I am, 5'9". Still another was nearly rectangular, as if the weight of time had flattened it out. Wood chips from the trees covered the ground. I picked up a handful. What I felt in my hand didn't match what I saw with my eyes. They were far too heavy. It was like picking up plastic checkers, only to discover they were made of lead. We left the petrified forest and ventured deep into the North Dakota Badlands, which looked like God couldn't decide whether to make another Arizona or Iowa. So he made both. We crested a hill, and in front of us stretched what appeared to be an endless green prairie. Behind us, clay formations dotted the dull gray expanse. In 3 days of hiking, we saw deer and antelope everywhere. We marveled at a bald eagle and laughed at yapping prairie dogs. The most dominant wildlife of Roosevelt's National Park were bison, which, more than any other animal, shaped Roosevelt's life. We saw dozens and dozens of them, enormous, shaggy brown beasts on whose backs you could watch a movie. I feel like this has to be mentioned. Bison dung is abundant, massive, and looks like spiral artwork. Roosevelt killed his first bison in 1883 after 2 weeks of difficult hunting and did a celebration dance. They were almost extinct by then, and he came to see their disappearance as a great loss for humanity. When Roosevelt killed his second bison a few years later, he didn't dance, and instead felt something close to regret, as if the death of each bison robbed the world of the great gift of being in awe of such a magnificent creature. "Few indeed," he wrote, "are the men who now have, or evermore shall have, the chance of seeing the mightiest of American beasts, in all his wild vigor, surrounded by the tremendous desolation of his far-off mountain home." His fascination with the magnificent creature was one factor in his devotion to conservation. In 1905, he helped start the American Bison Association. As president, he created big game preserves and supported plans to populate them with bison. Today, 101 years after his death, bison number 500,000. As the sun started to descend, John and I found a spot to camp on the edge of the prairie, overlooking the Badlands. As the sun set, bathing us in purple, pink, and orange light, we ate our dinner outside just as Roosevelt would have. A couple of bison munched on grass 100 yards away. Our spot was probably too close to them, but it was getting late, and it almost seemed like there were so many bison we couldn't have been able to find a spot that wasn't too close to at least one of them. I crawled into my tent knowing Roosevelt would have been overjoyed to sleep in their shadows like that. If all we saw of North Dakota was that hike, it would have been beautiful, serene, idyllic even. But it would have told only part of the story and not the important part. It was too easy, too perfect. I would have understood why Roosevelt loved North Dakota, but not how it changed him. Our hikes Friday night and Saturday morning on the lower Paddock Creek Trail disabused us of any misconception. Dark and angry clouds chased us all Friday afternoon. As the sun started to set, the clouds passed us and seemed to stop directly over us. We started setting up camp, even though the ground was covered with badland shrubs and barely suitable for camping. We crammed our tents on the only two patches of dirt big enough to hold them. Soon, the sky opened up. It didn't close for more than 12 hours. We passed a long night trying to sleep in tents that sounded like they were being beaten by octopuses with drumsticks in all eight tentacles. We packed up in a downpour and hiked out in a downpour. I wouldn't have been shocked to see the animals of the Badlands lining up two by two. We slipped and slid on the wet clay. It reminded me of walking on frozen lakes as a boy in Michigan, the only difference being falling on ice hurts more than falling on clay and leaves less of a mucky mess. We finally arrived at our rental SUV, covered in mud, and far more weary than we would have been had we hiked that distance in normal circumstances. We drove to the Cowboy Cafe in downtown Medora, where we scarfed down breakfast and talked about how we hated that hike and also loved it. And in completing it, gained insight we otherwise would have missed about how living here shaped Roosevelt. He could have let the physical misery on top of his emotional misery break him. Instead, he used it to build resilience in body and mind that would define the rest of his life. If he could endure the worst of North Dakota threw at him and keep going, he could endure anything and keep going. Roosevelt was a bundle of contradictions. He was a moral prude who counted roughnecks among his friends. He was aristocratic, but also devoted his adult life to public service. He went to North Dakota to be alone and spent the rest of his life, before and after, clamoring to be the center of attention. He wanted to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, and the infant at every christening, Sletten said. Roosevelt never lost the formality of the New York aristocrat he was, even as he embraced the minimalist lifestyle. The first day this intellectual cowboy spent in Medora, he went for a ride on a horse. So did John and I. And that's where we learned the most important lesson there is to learn about Roosevelt's life, how he responded to hardship. It isn't just that he endured struggles. It's what he took away from them that's important. We had barely left the stable when I heard a noise behind me. I looked back in time to see John flying off Denny, his horse. Just as John's butt lifted off the saddle and his feet left the stirrups, my blue roan quarter horse, Lakota, got spooked and started running. I yanked on the reins to stop her. When I looked back, I expected to see John in a crumpled mess on the ground. I hoped he had only broken a few bones. As he was flying through the air, he had the presence of mind not to try to catch himself. He knew he'd break his hands if he did that. The downside of that was that he landed on his face. Somehow he was unhurt, except for perhaps some bruised pride. He was already on his feet, smiling even. I wanted to leave and said so, framing it as a statement to John, not as a question. There is no way I would get back on a horse after that. But there was no way he was going to leave. He came to North Dakota to ride horses where Theodore Roosevelt rode horses, and he was not going to let one setback, scary though it might have been, stop him. from atop his horse, Slatton, who knows as much about how Roosevelt learned resilience in North Dakota as anyone, listen to our conversation. When John insisted the ride continue, Slatton nodded approvingly. Roosevelt always got back on the horse, he said. Here are two quotes attributed to Theodore Roosevelt. It is not the critic who counts. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by the dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who, at worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory or defeat. A soft, easy life is not worth living if it impairs the fiber of brain and heart and muscle. We must dare to be great, and we must realize that greatness is the fruit of toil and sacrifice and high courage. For us is the life of action, of strenuous performance, of duty. Let us live in the harness, striving mightily. Let us rather run the risk of wearing out than rusting out. Sam Shepard's New Mexico. The late icon's travelogues are paired with Ed Ruscha's photos in a new book by Hunter Hawk. In the introduction for the new book, Sam Shepard, New Mexico, writer-director Taylor Sheridan makes an observation about the late actor and playwright's storytelling prowess. Shepard's works, from the depictions of his own life to the dialogue in his acclaimed plays, always carry a noble purpose. To ask questions about ourselves we are scared to ask, Sheridan writes. To allow an audience to benefit from an experience without the burden of enduring it. That is the job of a storyteller. The new book, Sam Shepard, New Mexico, manages to weave together a new experience using powerful passages from different times and places. Shepard's stark, sometimes desperate inner dialogues from weary days on the roads of New Mexico are complemented by landscape photographs from the respected artist Ed Ruscha. We spoke to Lawless Media's John Miller about what inspired the new book. He's been an admirer of Shepard's storytelling prowess since the 1980s. After college, I went and worked at Esquire in New York as an art director there. They were publishing some of Sam Shepard's stuff from Motel Chronicles, and I totally fell in love with it. And at that time in the 80s in New York, I was able to see his plays True West and A Lie in the Mind and became completely hooked. I moved over to Vanity Fair, and they were doing a big story on Jessica Lange. She canceled the photo shoot in New York at the last minute because she was in Santa Fe. And I said to the photographer, "You have to go down there and shoot her in Santa Fe because you might get Sam." And they did. And the pictures were great, like way more interesting than just her alone. On deciding to publish a book fueled by Shepard's writings, besides working in magazines, I've also been a book packager and worked with a lot of major publishing companies and published more than 50 books for them. When I moved here to New Mexico a couple of years ago, I wanted to start a small press, and my first thought was, wow, there's all this great writing of Shepard's scattered here and there about New Mexico. It's some of his most interesting stuff, so I thought, let's put it into a book. Finding the right images to complement Shepard's words. I wanted to include images with Shepard's words that were not just pictures of him. Ed Ruscha's one of my favorite artists. I'm sure Shepard knew of Edward Ruscha. He's a pretty well-known artist, and I had spent a lot of time in California, too. Ed was a big admirer of Sam, and that's kind of why he agreed to do this. His studio found these, basically, outtakes from the 26 Gasoline Stations book, and he was very generous in letting me use them. The new book's reception in Santa Fe. I've put it in the bookstores here in town, but also in some galleries. Every place I go has a Sam Shepard story. He's a favorite son here, even though he's not from here. Everybody loves him and claims him as their own. The quality that binds the two artists' work. I think it's the desolation, the emptiness of those gas stations, Ruscha photographed, really mirrors where Shepard's stuff is set, you know, in a motel room or in a car. And it's always on the way somewhere. The Art Gallery. Tim Cox. It's a rare person who knows what they want out of life at a young age and never looks back. Tim Cox is one of the few. Having drawn since he could hold a pencil, the acclaimed Western artist was a working cowboy and already selling Western paintings years before high school. And he married his one and only sweetheart at the tender age of 17. Nearly 45 years and almost 500 paintings later, Tim and Susie Cox are still living the dream at their home outside Bloomfield, New Mexico, where Tim raises horses and paints. "It's just part of me. It's who I am and what I do," he says of his art. "If I didn't get paid for it, I'd still be doing it." His first canvas was a paper sack on the easel of his mother's kitchen floor, where the five-year-old drew bull riders, bucking horses, and Western scenes. His talent was obvious in kindergarten. "My teacher called my mom and dad in, and I thought I was in trouble," he remembers. "She just wanted to tell them they needed to get me art lessons." Cox must have been a local sensation in the small town of Duncan, Arizona, where his schools nurtured his artistic gift as best they could. By eighth grade, two teachers were even buying his paintings. "They gave me $5, and being in the eighth grade, I thought that was pretty good." Then the kids started buying them, and my dad started selling them at work. In the meantime, Cox discovered another passion, horses. "I'm a horse addict," he confesses, and today he owns about 20 at any given time. "If I have any weakness, it's horses." He was a good enough hand by the age of 8 that a rancher neighbor hired him for $1 a day to help with roundups and brandings. "They gave us a piece of country, and we'd just ride with them and help gather." At home, he'd spend hours looking at the Western art in Arizona Highways, the magazine his dad bought home from his highway department job. Tim's father, whose family has a ranching history, encouraged him. "That ranch I worked on didn't keep any of the mares," Cox says. "My dad talked them into giving me a filly. So when I was about 10 years old, I broke my first horse. I had her to ride for years." The ranch cowboys were fans of his art and posted the pictures on the barn wall. "A lot of them still have them today," Cox says. "They're kind of embarrassing to see, but it made me proud that they liked them." The young realist painter had no interest in the modern art favored by colleges and turned down several scholarship offers. But fate would provide him with better teachers. After marrying, Tim and Susie were taking care of horses at her parents' place when Cowboy Artists of America sculptor Grant Speed stopped at a neighbor's to buy a horse. Hearing there was an artist next door, Speed dropped by to see Cox's work and ended up inviting him to the upcoming Cowboy Artists of America show in Phoenix. An introduction to the folks at Trailside Galleries in Scottsdale, Arizona, soon followed, where Candice Bedner was an instant fan. "She took me right in as a gallery artist," Cox says. "I didn't know what a big deal it was at the time. She became a very close person in my life and helped me with my career tremendously. Tim and Susie became so close to Bednar, who had no children of her own, that when she died in 2004, the obituary called the couple her near son and daughter-in-law. Cox met other mentors that included some of the biggest names in Western art, like John Clymer and Gordon Snydell. Snydell invited Cox to spend a summer painting at his Ruidoso, New Mexico guest house, where the master would offer daily critiques of his protege's work. Despite the early success, there were lean years. For a time, Cox painted at night while spending his days cowboying on a remote Arizona ranch. When he finished a painting, he would drive to Trailside Galleries, stopping first in Sedona, Arizona, to see famed Western artist Jim Reynolds. Jim Reynolds would critique it, Cox says, and I always took my paint and brushes so I could work on it if I needed to. Reynolds' style was looser and more impressionistic. But he told me, if you're going to be a realist painter, be the best realist painter you can be, Cox recalls. Right before he died, he emailed me and asked me if I remembered that. I said yes, and he said, well, I'll be damned if you didn't just about become it. The memory makes Cox chuckle. He wouldn't give me the whole deal. He just said just about. But it was nice to get the email from him. Today, Cox's paintings are so popular it can be a challenge to buy an original. His new works, portraying the present-day cowboy and ranch life, are rarely in galleries and quickly snapped up at shows like the prestigious Prix de West in Oklahoma City. Cox won the show's top honor in 2003, one of many awards over the years, and he achieved his lifelong dream of becoming a member of the Cowboy Artists of America in 2007. His spot-on paintings of horses, dramatic western skies, and ranch scenes are clearly the work of someone who lives the life. A lot of the collectors say they just like to sit down with a glass of wine and transpose themselves into the painting and feel like they're there, he says. Indeed, sitting in front of a Cox, you feel like you can almost smell the sage. He still saddles up spring and fall to visit working ranches and to get recharged and re-inspired before disappearing into his studio, where he often paints for 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. I get so lost in it when I'm doing it, I can't think of much else, Cox says. It's just part of who I am. Joe Pickett's next chapter. Author C.J. Box returns with the beloved game warden character in his latest modern Western novel, Long Range, by Ian Neely. Striding across the landscape of an imperfect modern-day Wild West, populated by homicidal cowboys, assassins, and a shady bureaucrat, Game Warden Joe Pickett is almost a perfect hero. The fictional character is not without his flaws. He's a terrible shot and is often fooled or beaten by his foes, at least initially. With his ironclad determination to do the right thing, he sees that justice is served, and he's had a lot of practice doing it. New York Times best-selling author C.J. Box has written about the game warden for nearly 20 years. The 20th book in his Joe Pickett series, Long Range, is out now. In this new story, the stalwart game warden races against time to identify and capture a sniper who has attempted to kill an eccentric local judge. To make matters worse, Pickett's unpredictable friend, Nate Romanowski, falls under the suspicion of the authorities and a new enigmatic sheriff. As Joe unravels the mystery, he finds himself in the crosshairs of a murderer's high-powered rifle. Box says that after a couple of decades, The popular protagonist is the same man he introduced in his first book, Open Season, but older, harder, and a little more cynical. He's somebody who has kind of benefited from his experiences and is also a little scarred by some of them, Box says, adding that the book series takes place in real time. I just hope that he has progressed in a realistic way. He's not as naive by any means as he was in the first few books. The author also constructs novels now in the same way he did when he was first crafting them in 2001. I've done so many books now, it's gotten a little easier in terms of craft, but I still start with one or two issues that are localized in the Mountain West, or things that are national, and I research those issues and then build a story based around them, he says. With Long Range, he says the idea came about because of the popularity of long-distance shooting, which has taken over the target shooting world with its advancements in technology, optics, and bullets. I went and fired some of those long-distance rifles to get a handle on it, and I was hitting targets I couldn't see with my naked eye, over 1,000 yards right out of the box. It's amazing, Box says. He admits that the one thing he enjoys most about writing a new novel is creating a memorable villain. It's kind of cathartic in a way, but I try not to make them too black and white, Box says. They've got to be real people and have some nuance to them. Those not already introduced to Box's Stetson-wearing hero will soon get the chance to experience his stories off the page. The author says Joe Pickett's adventures will soon become a TV series. Yep, things are about to get real Western. Cowboys Who Care. The nonprofit foundation brings hats and smiles to pediatric patients. By Wendy Wilkinson. The license plates in the parking lot of Children's Hospital Colorado in Aurora, just outside of Denver, says it all. I see cars not just from Colorado, but from New Mexico, Nevada, North Dakota, and other states in the West. Ranked by U.S. News and World Report as one of the top pediatric oncology programs in the country for the last decade, this hospital on the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus attracts people with sick children from all over. I'm here to find out more about a very special group called the Cowboys Who Care Foundation. The volunteer-based nonprofit brings cowboy hats to kids in treatment. The foundation's first and most frequent supporter, Resistol, has provided thousands of free hats in various sizes and styles, with a special comfort fit liner that helps children with scalp sensitivity. To date, the foundation has given away more than 9,000 hats. I find the volunteer department, where a group of 8 meet up for a day of bringing smiles to kids who are going through something tough. In addition to 2019's Miss Rodeo, Kansas Brooke Wallace, who serves as a Cowboys Who Care ambassador and is now Miss Rodeo USA, and 2019's Miss Rodeo Colorado, Kelly Stockton, we're also joined by several parents whose children, former patients here, are in remission. Waiting for us is a wagon full of Resistol cowboy hats from Cowboys Who Care, along with spurs and buckles, courtesy of the National Little Britches Rodeo Association. Wallace got involved with Cowboys Who Care when she saw an ad on Facebook asking for cowboys who wanted to volunteer for hospital visits. As Miss Rodeo Kansas, 2019, that was something that really interested me, as I had a platform to really help them out, Wallace says. I've been to 4 or 5 hospitals during my reign as Miss Rodeo Kansas, and can't say enough about Cowboys Who Care, as they truly have their hearts in the right place and work very hard to set up these hospital visits. The reward for Wallace is seeing the expressions on the kids' faces when they're given a cowboy hat. "It's so joyous," she says. "A children's hospital wing is not always the happiest place to be. So we came into Children's Hospital Colorado with our happy faces, gave them a hat as well as spurs and belt buckles, and told them that they could be a cowboy or a cowgirl, too." Before boarding the elevator to the oncology unit, our Cowboys Who Care contingent stops off at Seacrest Studios, a nonprofit media initiative providing programming to pediatric hospitals, in the lobby. There we meet Ralph, the therapy dog, a yellow Labrador who's keeping several of the less critically ill kids company. The atmosphere is relaxed and buoyant. We head for isolation and don gloves, gowns, and masks. Then we set off on rounds, gently putting cowboy hats at the foot of empty beds for children to enjoy later. We visit 7-year-old Cross, who is here being treated for leukemia. He lights up as he puts on a big straw cowboy hat and holds a little breeches belt buckle. We speak with 2 young teens about their love of horses. Allie, age 13, rode her 4 first horses in New Zealand, a chestnut named Arrow and a gray named Stella, before she got sick. "Maybe I'll be a cowgirl when I get home," Allie says. Kuma, age 12, rode her first horse at a camp in Denver, a tall one who wanted to go very fast, and hopes to continue riding when she is able. Though we were in Colorado, Cowboys Who Care is based in Rome, Texas. Founded in 2012 by comedian and writer William Lee Martin and his wife Michelle, the foundation states its mission is providing smiles, support, and free brand-new cowboy hats to boys and girls with cancer and other life-threatening illnesses. The inspiration behind it was a teen from Salina, Texas, named Ashley Miller, who was fighting a rare form of cancer. Martin met Ashley when he was headlining a fundraiser on her behalf. Unfortunately, Ashley did not survive, but Martin was so moved by her that he decided to do something to honor her memory and help other sick children. He did an internet image search of kids with cancer and found photo after photo of big, beautiful smiles and bald heads. Seeing his own cowboy-hatted reflection in the mirror, Martin realized those kids needed cowboy hats. Almost 10 years on, Cowboys Who Care gets requests for hats every week. We have recently started the Request a Hat program at cowboyswhocare.org, where, without a hospital visit, parents can order a hat free of charge with no shipping cost. This year, we're also adding a scholarship program for kids who have survived pediatric cancer. But hospital visits remain at the heart of the program. Over the last year, Cowboys Who Care volunteers have taken hats in person to kids at Sunrise Children's Hospital in Las Vegas during the National Finals Rodeo, Wesley Children's Hospital in Wichita, Kansas, Children's Medical Center in Dallas, and Mary Bridge Children's Hospital in Tacoma, Washington, among others. My visit to Children's Hospital, Colorado, left me with poignant, indelible memories. A mother who has been by her daughter's side nonstop, alerting the desk that she needs the private bathroom door unlocked so she can take a shower. A family of 5 with rowdy and tired children in a wagon, there to support their little brother who is in isolation. The tween zone, where non-isolation patients and their friends and family hang out together playing games and listening to music. The high-wattage smiles of the rodeo queens and the heart-tugging grins they put on the faces of the kids wearing their new cowboy hats. Not everyone who gets a hat will get a happy outcome. But as I leave in the non-critical care unit, they're throwing a party for an 8-year-old girl who has just finished her final round of chemotherapy. Ward nurses unveil a celebratory cake. The family raise their arms in a canopy as the child, proudly supporting her cowboy hat, excitedly runs beneath, climbs a step stool, and rings the hospital's warrior bell. It proclaims the victorious message: ring this bell for to tell of heroic deeds worthwhile. Your treatment is done, the battle has been won. Now it's time to smile. Dances with Wolves. 30 years ago, against all odds, Kevin Costner's masterful Western hit theaters and went on to win the Oscar for Best Picture. By David Hofstede. Kevin's Gate. That's how movie industry experts described Dances with Wolves prior to its release, especially after its star, Kevin Costner, had to invest $3 million of his own money to finish the film. Bad enough he was making a Western in 1990, when cowboy movies were as popular as the Exxon Valdez that had just crashed into Alaska. But a 3-hour Western with subtitled Indians, where U.S. soldiers were the bad guys? A movie with such limited box office prospects that Costner directed only because no one else wanted the job? Talk about a bloated vanity project and box office poison. What no one figured on was the film being good, as in really good, as in $400 million box office worldwide and 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director for Costner, and Best Screenplay for Michael Blake, who had been living out of his car while writing the book on which the film was based. At heart, this is the redemption tale of John Dunbar, a suicidal Union Army officer befriended by the Lakota Sioux. He begins a new and better life in their company, one that becomes threatened by the army he left and the Pawnees who are warring with the Sioux. What made Dances with Wolves so groundbreaking was its portrayal of the Lakota and the attention to detail devoted to their lifestyle, culture, and language. For authenticity, Costner hired a teacher at South Dakota's Sintigleska University to translate more than a quarter of the script into the Lakota Sioux dialect spoken in the 1860s. Roger Ebert gave the movie 4 stars, describing it as a simple story, magnificently told, with the epic sweep and clarity of a Western by John Ford, and lauding it for seeing the Sioux as people, not as whooping savages in the sights of an army rifle. The audience, he writes, gets to know many members of the Sioux tribe, especially Kicking Bird, Graham Greene, who was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, Wind in His Hair, Rodney A. Grant, and the old wise chief, Ten Bears, Floyd Red Crow Westerman. Each has a strong personality. These are men who know exactly who they are. It's a study of these people, West Studi says. You see them like you see the other characters. You like them or dislike them for their own personalities. And they do have personalities, more developed than you've seen in previous films. Michael Blake, who passed away in 2019, chronicled the further adventures of Dances with Wolves and Stands with a Fist in his 2001 sequel novel, The Holy Road. A TV miniseries based on the book has been listed as in development for several years, but Costner has declined participation. Would you settle for a remake? Check out James Cameron's Avatar, still one of the highest-grossing films of all time. More than one film critic has dubbed it Dances with Wolves in Space. Wes Studi, Toughest Pawnee. Last year, Wes Studi received an honorary Academy Award for a distinguished film career, highlighted by iconic performances in The Last of the Mohicans, 1992, Geronimo, An American Legend, 1993, and The Only Good Indian, 2009. But 30 years ago, he was the 28th billed cast member in Dances with Wolves, playing a character identified only as Toughest Pawnee. It was only his second film, and when he finished shooting, he returned to his regular job, selling jewelry at an Indian store in Reseda, California. After the film opened, he wouldn't have to work there much longer. We caught up with Studi for a quick chat about the film that, in his words, first put him on the radar of casting directors and other filmmakers. Does it seem like 30 years ago? Seems like more. It's been a while. How did you get the part? It was quite a process. When they started casting, I went in for an audition and a callback, but I did not know if I had the part for at least a month after that. And then I finally got word that I had it. Shooting a film on such an epic scale must have been quite a change from your first film, Pow Wow Highway, in 1989. It was a big deal, but actually, Dances with Wolves was also an independent film, though it had some studio backing, and in terms of budget, there was a difference from Pow Wow Highway. But for me, it was just a great opportunity to be in a big film. It was also great to meet a lot of other Indian actors that were also involved, many of whom I still work with from time to time. That's where I met Tantu Cardinal for the first time, and our careers have continued to touch base on different projects. What was it like having Kevin Costner as a director? It was a good experience. He was always very congenial and professional. He knew what he wanted to get, and he shot until he got it. How did you approach the role of Toughest Pawnee? Oh, I never play a villain. The purpose of the Pawnee in the film was to provide the threat, both to the Army and to the Sioux. But Toughest Pawnee was in the right as far as he was concerned, and that's how I approached the role. He was in a desperate situation and doing what he thought was best. So as far as I was concerned, he was a good guy. You spoke Cherokee as a young man. Did that help at all with learning the language you spoke in the film? I think it was very much like a French guy trying to learn Russian. The languages are extremely different. They had no relation to one another except that they're not English. We learned our dialogue from tapes, and then, more or less, we had to invent our own intonations and what we thought were the right keywords to hit. What were your expectations for the film? Were you surprised at the reception from critics and audiences? There was a theater right across the street from the store where I was working in Reseda. It was showing the film, and at the time it opened, it wasn't a huge success. At first, people didn't flock to see it. But within a week or two, the lines around the theater began to multiply, and after a while, they were turning people away. It blossomed through word of mouth and the press that got it. It was a slow build, but it was a terrific build, to say the least. There was talk of a Dances with Wolves sequel for years after the film came out. Are you sorry now they didn't do it, or was it best to leave well enough alone? I leave those decisions to the gods of filmmaking. Either way, we knew your character wasn't coming back. Right. It wouldn't have mattered to me. Where the Buffalo Roam. These days, a script calling for a buffalo stampede would be sent to the CGI department to create one on a computer. In 1990, the only option was to find a real herd. That took Kevin Costner and company to northern Stanley County, South Dakota. The bison hunt scenes in Dances with Wolves were filmed at the Standing Butte Ranch. Its unspoiled rolling hills, creeks, and native prairie grasses, not to mention its thousands of buffalo, all looked in 1990 much the same as they did when Lewis and Clark's Corps of Discovery surveyed Stanley County in 1804. After being owned by the same family for half a century, the 46,000-acre ranch was scheduled to go on the auction block in parcels, but Ted Turner stepped in and bought the entire acreage in 2015. Two Socks was Two Wolves. Two Socks, a wolf character almost as famous as the one that menaced the Three Little Pigs, was actually played by two wolves named Teddy and Buck. "I hated those wolves," Costner confessed at a 2009 film festival appearance. They did not take direction well, causing the film to run weeks behind schedule. In the scene for which John Dunbar is given his name, Dances with Wolves, by the Lakota, Costner stuffed meat in his pockets to hold the wolves' attention.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
HEB, in partnership with Favor Delivery, started Friday, a service that gives seniors access to a personal shopper by phone, allowing them to get essential food and supplies delivered to them while remaining in the comfort and safety of their home. Times are 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., 7 days a week. To access the senior support line, call 1-833-397-0080. Again, that number is 1-833-397-0080. To find out more about the program, visit favordelivery.com/senior.
This week on Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night at the Movies, Air Force One.
Air Force One is down.
Communist radicals hijack Air Force One with the U.S. president and his family on board.
Where is the wife and daughter?
The vice president negotiates from Washington, D.C.
The president is up there with a gun to his head.
While the president, a veteran, fights to rescue the hostages on board.
I'm the president of the United States.
Harrison Ford.
Atrocity and terror are not political weapons. And to those who would use them, your day is over.
Gary Oldman.
I will execute a member of the senior staff and continue killing one hostage every minute until the plane crash or refueling plane arrives.
And Glenn Close.
If we're going to act, we have to act now.
One of the most popular action films of the 1990s.
Liberty 2-4, do you have the president?
Air Force One. Audio described.
Your commander-in-chief has issued a direct order. Do it!
Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 76 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Country Music by Dayton Duncan, based on a documentary film by Ken Burns Read for you by Brian Corrigan, Dayton Duncan, and Ken Burns. Billy Sherrill was Nashville's most reliable country-politan hitmaker. As a boy, Sherrill had been steeped in gospel music,